I will call the second case, case number A242025, in the matter of civil commitment of Jill McLarnon. Counsel, as you're getting settled, I will just remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Feel free to adjust the podium up or down according to your comfort. And before you begin your argument, please identify yourself and the party that you represent. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gabe Munson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Jill McLarnon. Ms. McLarnon was civilly committed by district court order following a commitment trial in December 2024. And the court found that she met the civil commitment criteria. We have a primary argument and alternative argument that was laid out in the briefs. And our primary argument is that the county failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Ms. McLarnon posed a substantial likelihood of physical harm to herself. Now, the district court based that conclusion on two separate criteria. One was that she failed to provide herself with necessary shelter, and two, that she failed to provide herself with necessary medical care. And in the brief, we laid those out separately and talked about the different deficiencies in each separate basis. And I don't want to minimize the mental health symptoms that Ms. McLarnon was experiencing. I can see why the district court may have thought that she would benefit from a civil commitment. She was homeless. She was experiencing psychosis symptoms. She had infestation of lice. And it was a situation where she likely benefited from being civilly committed.
Just to be clear, you're not challenging that she has a substantial psychiatric disorder on appeal, correct?
No, we're not. But whether a civil commitment would benefit Ms. McLarnon is not the statutory criteria in the civil commitment statute. The court must find that the county proved by clear and convincing evidence that she posed a substantial likelihood of physical harm to herself. And there's four separate bases laid out in Minnesota Statute 253B.02, Subdivision 17A. And the court found that under paren 1, failure to provide herself with the enumerated necessities, that she met the civil commitment criteria.
Counsel, isn't there quite a bit of evidence in the record that by declining medical treatment and refusing to accept treatment even for the lice in particular, that there was a substantial risk of harm to herself?
Your Honor, there was evidence throughout the record that she was declining treatment for lice.
And why is that evidence that's in the record insufficient to meet the statutory requirements for commitment?
Because the record before the court and the court's findings of fact do not connect that declining those treatments to the statutory criteria. And I think the court here, what's in the record is a lot of concerning behavior. Strange decisions that don't seem to be in Ms. McLarnon's best interest, but they were never connected to why they met the statutory criteria, and they were never connected to why those pose a substantial likelihood of physical harm. She did decline lice treatment. It's also clear in the record that she accepted antibiotic treatment for cellulitis, and I'd point the court to Exhibit 2, page 59, and Exhibit 4, page 53 and 82. When she was initially presented at the emergency department, she accepted antibiotic treatment of ANSEF for cellulitis. And if you look at those exhibits that I just brought up, Exhibit 2, page 59, you'll see that the doctors noted that she had no signs of infection at the time and that antibiotic treatment was not necessary. So what the court never did here was say why the treatments that she was declining, which was a certain treatment for her scalp, for lice, and showering to remove the lice, why those met the statutory harm criteria. And the record does not say why, and the court's findings do not say why.
I thought the court recognized, perhaps more generally than you would like, that her refusal to accept the lice treatment prevented her from receiving the necessary psychiatric care, that was included in the medical care. And wasn't that, you know, in the record, wasn't there record support for by one of the, I think it was Dr. Johnson, but maybe I have the wrong psychiatrist here, saying that she needed residential care for what you agree is a substantial mental illness, and she wasn't going to be accepted into that residential care when she had lice.
There was evidence in the record that said that. I think one thing there is why the court in the record never answered the question of why her not getting that inpatient care would lead to a substantial likelihood of physical harm. She'd been homeless for a period up to that time. That homelessness in the record was never connected directly to her mental illness. The question is never answered why her not getting that inpatient care would lead to a substantial likelihood of physical harm. And that's why that evidence in the record is deficient.
Well, but wasn't there evidence in the record that, with respect to her homelessness, that she was sleeping at a bus stop, that while she was there, she actually fell and hit her head and incurred injuries? I mean, isn't that evidence of physical harm that's tied to the homelessness?
It is evidence of physical harm. I will note that the statute notes that the physical harm has to be caused by the impairment. And in this case, that would be the mental illness. And there isn't evidence in the record that ties her homelessness or the harm that she suffered while being homeless to her mental illness. And that's required by the statute. And she may have been hurt at a bus stop, but there's not evidence that supports why that meets the civil commitment criteria and why that's tied to her impairment.
But isn't the medical clearly tied to it? I mean, as Judge Justin said, the district court focused on her failure to get the lice treatment, how that impaired her ability to get medical treatment and impaired her ability to get psychiatric treatment. And as you acknowledged, she does have a mental illness that needs to be treated. So isn't that a direct tie to the mental illness with the medical treatment issue?
And Your Honor, when in the brief we laid out the homelessness issue separate from the failure to provide medical care. And the reason for that is because the deficiencies are different in each case. When we look at the homelessness, there it's not tied to her mental health. When we look at the failure to receive medical care, it is tied to her mental health. It was based on delusional thinking. The reason that the lack of medical care is deficient is that the record in the court never laid out why the treatment that she was refusing would create a substantial likelihood of physical harm. When we look at the homelessness, we'll see that there's different deficiencies. But when we look at the medical care issue, it's not clear in the record why the treatments that she did refuse, while there were others that she did accept, why those would create a substantial likelihood of physical harm.
Well, isn't it kind of apparent that if you don't get treatment for lice, that's not a good situation? That in and of itself is causing physical harm?
Your Honor, it may be apparent, it's definitely not a good idea to not get treatment for lice, but that connection to the statute can't be assumed. And that was the reason that I cited the Lennard decision in our case. Even though Lennard was not reversed, it was remanded for further findings. In Lennard, we have a woman who was civilly committed under the same statute, and she cut herself, smeared blood on her face at the command of God. And this court said that's not enough because the district court never explained why that meets the commitment criteria. That's more egregious behavior than we have in McLarnon. And the Lennard case is not published, and it's persuasive authority, but I'd ask this court to consider that case as persuasive authority because it holds the district court to the commitment standard. And what I think the main
counsel in that, I've got that opinion in front of me. What in that case we're talking about, where the district court adopted an order that the county had drafted, hadn't made changes to it, and didn't consider a stay of commitment that was suggested by the examiner. That seems like a much different set of circumstances than we have here.
It is a different set of circumstances, and it was drafted by the county. This order in the McLarnon case was not drafted by the county. But it was not remanded because the county drafted the order. It was remanded because the findings were insufficient. And there it was remanded separately, both for insufficient risk of harm findings, and that's where you see the discussion of the smearing blood, and separately for failure to consider the less restrictive alternative. It was both bases in that case. It was a different factual case, but there are similarities to the present case. There was a separate issue brought up by the county in their brief, the respondent in their brief, and that was the standard of review that this court should apply. The standard of review that this court should apply is the de novo review standard.
To and what?
To whether the county proved the civil commitment criteria.
But aren't you making challenges to the factual findings as well?
No, Your Honor. We're challenging the conclusion of law that appellant poses substantial likelihood of physical harm. That involves a factual analysis, but the challenge is to the conclusion of law. And in the case law, there's a clear distinction between whether someone challenges a factual finding or a conclusion of law. If it's a conclusion of law, it's considered a question of law, and this court applies a de novo standard.
Right, but on your brief at pages 11 through 12, I think you're challenging the factual finding that she refused treatment, the medical treatment, and that it's not supported by the record. So if that's the case, wouldn't we look at that as under the clearly erroneous standard?
Your Honor, when the question on a when a appellant challenges the conclusion of law, the question is whether the civil commitment criteria were met. And the question is whether the trial record and the findings of fact support that conclusion of law. So it involves an analysis of the record. That's different than challenging the accuracy of a specific factual finding. In this case, when we challenge the conclusion of law that she's a substantial likelihood of physical harm, it must involve an analysis of the facts in the record. And here, I think there are some similarities, but when the challenge is specifically to the conclusion of law and whether the facts in the record support that. And that's why that discussion took place in the brief.
Right, and let me just clarify, just speaking for myself, how I view it. It seems to me that this is like a nested standard of review. So the overarching standard of review that I think you're challenging is under the error standard. In other words, we review de novo. But underneath that is a challenge to the factual findings, and that factual finding we review for clear error. So if we conclude that the district court's factual findings were clearly erroneous, then as a result, our de novo review would be that the district court erred. But in order to get to that final one, we still have to look at the initial factual finding issue that you're raising. So I think there are two different ones that are applicable here, at least based on the way I read your brief. And so there are actually two that seem to apply here. One is de novo, but then the other is for the factual findings of clearly erroneous. Would that be a fair way of framing it?
Your Honor, I'd respectfully disagree that we're challenging a factual finding. It may have been unclear in my brief, but just to be clear, we are specifically challenging that conclusion of law and whether it's supported. And I cited the Martin decision to support the argument that a de novo review standard should be applied. And when the issue was raised by the county, I looked for some further case law. I'd also point the court to the commitment of Jankilla, Jankilla, 657 Northwest 2nd, 899 at 902, which says, we review de novo the question of whether the evidence is sufficient to meet the standard of commitment. And I don't think that requires a nested argument where you also challenge the findings. When we're looking at that conclusion of law, the question is whether the evidence meets the commitment criteria. I'd also note that in Spicer, the case that was cited lower in the order about the remand for further findings, that case also says we apply a de novo standard of review to the question whether the facts found by the district court satisfy the criteria for commitment, which is a question of law. And that's our specific argument. We're not challenging the accuracy of any findings. I think, and maybe the brief wasn't clear on that, and I think the county may have misinterpreted our argument. To clarify today, it's a challenge to the conclusion of law.
And I'm just, the reason why I'm asking that clarification is in your brief on page 11, it says, quote, absent clear and convincing evidence that appellant's homelessness is a result of the impairment, the district court cannot conclude appellant failed to obtain shelter as a result. So I saw it as a challenge to the factual findings and of the clearly erroneous and of the de novo. So that's what I based it on.
Okay. And I just have 10 seconds left. I just asked this court to reverse this commitment because the county did not prove their case with clear and convincing evidence. In the alternative, we'd ask this court to remand for further findings because the findings are inadequate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of respondent, the county, today. I agree, Judge Reyes, with your interpretation of the nesting standard of review. I always hate having to look at that before an argument because I worry I'm back in law school, I'm going to miss the quiz. I agree, though. You have to find a problem with the factual findings and whether they meet the clearly erroneous standard to then apply the de novo standard. And so in my reading of the brief, and perhaps I misinterpreted it, the findings were being challenged. Here, I think the record supports the findings that the district court made. I think that the record also establishes that because of appellant's lice, she was refusing treatment for the lice as a result of her impairment. She thought that she needed to save anything that she pulled from her body to show that people had to show the bugs to people, to show that they had been planted. And so her impairment impacted her ability to have insight into what was going on and to make decisions about whether or not to accept treatment. As a result of refusing treatment, she was not able to get shelter. That is on transcript page 22 by Dr. Johnson, where he talks about how that often will limit an individual's access to shelter. And I think as a result—
Also, one of the things that does trouble me a bit is, you know, if we were asked to commit everyone who is homeless, who has a mental illness, and it's uncontested here that she was without housing and that she has a substantial psychiatric disorder, I mean, that would be a whole lot of people. That seems to me to be a very, very broad way to read the commitment statute, and that concerns me. Can you help me with that?
You're right, Your Honor, and I agree with you. That would be a very broad interpretation of it. We already have a problem getting appropriate housing for individuals who've been civilly committed. And I think here the difference is there is harm. She was at the bus shelter without shoes. It was the winter. There's some photographs in the record. I believe I've cited to them in my brief, but I don't remember the page. But in some of the exhibits before the district court, there was some damage to her shoe, to her feet from a lack of footwear. So here there is that harm that's established. We'll often see cases that are referred to the office where someone is homeless and intoxicated, but that's not enough. We don't just civilly commit someone because of their decision to imbibe in alcohol and their decision to, or whatever circumstances may lead to their unhousing situation. And so here I think it's close, but I think it's enough. Without the lice, without the damage to the feet, maybe we're at a different scenario.
Well, let's put aside the medical issue. I want to focus on the homelessness as well, because yes, while she acknowledged that she was injured while she was sleeping at the bus stop, she said that because of her homelessness, she had a very erratic sleep pattern.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that seems to make sense. I think of times when I've been sleeping in a place where like it is very loud or a lot of interruptions, and you wake up and you're very groggy, and it's like, you know, okay, where am I? And where are my shoes? And how do I even take care of myself? My concern with that is, how do we know it's that accident wasn't just tied to her homelessness and sleep deprivation based on her homelessness situation versus being tied to her mental health?
Your Honor, I think because she was not at a shelter, because she would not have been accepted at a shelter because of the lice infestation, which she would not accept treatment for as a result of her mental illness. I think that's how we know that then she's in the situation where she is in the shelter and she, or excuse me, in the bus shelter, wrong shelter. She's in the bus shelter and she is homeless and she doesn't have adequate clothing or adequate footwear. So I think they're inextricably interlinked in a sense here. And that's why the statute allows you to look at all of them. You need to find one, but here I think there's both of them kind of backing one another up.
So let's, if we can move over to the medical treatment prong. So you heard my questions with appellant's counsel saying, okay, well, she wasn't getting residential treatment because of her refusal to get the lice treatment. And his point was, yes, but that's, you know, if there's, that still does, there still is insufficient evidence of substantial risk of harm by not getting the residential treatment. Could you address that specifically,
please? I disagree with that, Your Honor, because there is testimony from Dr. Johnson that she would not allow anyone to give her medical treatment, that because she would had lice, she wouldn't be permitted to go into the shelter. I think it's on transcript page 22. She also talks about, he also described that she decompensated over time, that there had been frequent visits to the emergency room. I think the state brought that up in their closing argument, which was based on the records that are included and cited to specifically. If you look at the standard under Kenny, the findings have to be clearly erroneous, or only clearly erroneous when manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. Here, we look at the entire record. And so I think that helps to bolster it.
So did he testify not only, I remember the part about she decompensated up to this point. Is mm-hmm. there, you know, does he talk about what will happen if she doesn't get care?
Yes, I'm looking at page, I discuss his testimony on pages 4 through 6 of my brief. In his testimony on page 6, he's testifying that she doesn't have insight nor the capacity to make decisions regarding medication. So that's why they sought the Jarvis order, which is not being challenged here, that she would not be able to take the medication, which would help her to treat her mental illness, which would then hopefully lead to treatment of lice and then lead to her to either remain homeless if she wished to or had to, or she could go to a shelter if she chose to do so. But it would put her in a better position to not have a potential for harm for herself due to a lack of treatment and a lack of resources there. He does talk about that he opined that she met the criteria for civil commitment. He testified that he believed she needed an inpatient residential mental health treatment but would not be admitted to such a program while she had active lice. He also talked a little bit about the records talk about how she would not shower and would not wash them away because she wanted to save the evidence to press charges. That's why I think without this medication and without this treatment, there was no moving forward and it would just be a circle of not being admitted somewhere. I agree this is a scant order. I would appreciate more of an order with more details. I would be remiss if I didn't say that with the volume at Hennepin, the orders sometimes are scant. That's not an excuse. However, here it is distinguishable from Lennard. It's not a proposed order. It's also distinguishable from Lindquist. There's not statutory language missing. It's not a form that's incorrect. The district court heard this. It was all the referee heard this, and it was also signed off on by a district court judge. Here, I think there is enough evidence, and I think when you look at the factual findings, none are clearly erroneous. And so in light of that, I think that the de novo standard also in applying those factual findings is met here. So I would respectfully ask that you affirm. Unless there are further questions, I would rest on my brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Seeing none, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel pointed out both foot injuries and the fact that Ms. McLarnon would not be able to find housing with the current lice infestation. And on my initial argument, we talked a lot about our primary argument that the statutory criteria were not met. I just asked this court to really look closely at the district court's commitment order. We don't have information about foot injuries in that order. We don't have much information about future lack of housing. If we look on page 3, she testified, and it's talking about Ms. McLarnon. She testified she was unsure of where she would go if released from the hospital. The facts in the record that opposing counsel point out don't appear to have been considered by the district court in making their conclusion that Ms. McLarnon met the civil commitment criteria. This order does not identify what facts the court found to be true. It does not really identify the evidence that it used to support each conclusion. There are some citations to the record, to both the examiner's report and other medical records, but they're more summaries of the evidence that came in rather than saying, these are the facts that this court found to be true.
But the order does say, I mean, it says, for instance, on paragraph 37, quote, the court is concerned about records indicating that respondent has license is refusing treatment and assistance for her condition. Respondent has not been able to engage in appropriate treatment. I don't see that as just, you know, quoting. The district court is expressing its own concern based on the record, which seems to indicate that it actually did carefully consider all the evidence that had been presented to it.
I agree that language is there, and there is one credibility finding at the top of page 3 that says Dr. Paris persuasively opines in her report that during her current hospitalization, respondent has been declining these certain treatments, and that's at the top of page 3. Other than that, it's primarily either conclusory or summaries of testimony. And the findings that the court made do not get us to that commitment criteria. And that's where it's lacking. There are a few findings of fact that suggest an analysis of the record, but overall, we don't know exactly what the court found to be true and what they didn't. And unless the court has any further questions, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both counsel. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. We will now adjourn to consider our non-oral cases. Okay.